Okay, I'm here with Jason Healy today, and we are talking about his book, his volume of Fierce Domain, Conflict in Cyberspace, 1986 to 2012. So this is I started reading it about a week ago, and it's definitely a sort of a history book, and it sort of details, you know, what we would consider information security, network security, and sort of goes through from 1986 to about now, and looking at sort of major events and sort of what we can learn and what we, you know, should as policymakers and as InfoSec people sort of derive from these major events. With that being said, I think you know, the Loopcast audience, it's both NatSec people, policy people, and sort of InfoSec people, and I think this volume is sort of useful in the sense that, you know, I think for people who work on the policy side, it does establish that, you know, cyber and cyber conflict, whatever you want to call it, has been around for about 30, 40 years. It's nothing new. Mm-hmm. And it's nothing unique. And then for the InfoSec people, I think it does give you history about, you know, in the sense that history and insight to how policy is made and sort of, you know, whether it succeeded or not, you know, it's not my place to say, but it does give you insight how the government and how policy people view the problem of networks. So I, you know, check it out at your local library, buy it, whatever. But I think it's definitely a short and sort of useful volume to look at. And so let's start off with Jason. You know, walk us through the structure of this study, because I mean, you do break down this history into sort of three phases. You know, what you call realization, takeoff, and militarization. So walk us through those three sort of separations and sort of partitions, if you will.
Yeah, and you hit the nature of the book really well, because it hit us that InfoSec people don't necessarily understand this from a national security way and the way this gets seen in the Pentagon and the White House and the Beltway, and that's my experience. But we also found that the true national security types were, I think, getting a bit of a bum steer from the cyber people, from the InfoSec people, about what was true when you look at cyber conflict. So this book is meant for both types, and we're trying to demystify cyber for the wonks, and we're trying to demystify policy stuff for the geeks. And so when you look at structure, yes, we did break it up into three periods, and we started in 1986. So I'll start my answer with answering the question I get a lot, why 1986? So if you know information security history, you might guess why 1986, because it was a cyber espionage case called the Cuckoo's Egg, where a few German hackers, Hanover hackers, were breaking into national labs, defense industrial base companies, and the Pentagon, looking for classified information on Star Wars, President Reagan's strategic defense initiative, you know, the lasers in space kind of thing. And what we found was if you took that cyber espionage case, which is very poorly known by most cyber defenders in the military or Washington, D.C. today, we found it was not only different from what had come before. You could look at the kinds of things prior to 1986, and you could think of them as computer crime. You could think of them as computer security. You could think of them as signals intelligence or electronic warfare. And that mindset that you would bring from any of those terms, from any of those professions, would serve you very well. But Cuckoo's Egg was different than all of those things. It wasn't just computer crime. It wasn't just electronic warfare or one of the other things that many people say cyber is. So it was different. But also, if you look at the things that made it different, Cuckoo's Egg different, those same things, those underlying dynamics, are almost the same as they are today. For example, you read Kristol, the guy that investigated and wrote about it, and what he says about trying to trace back these guys into where they were, to try and get help from law enforcement, from the technical things he was doing, like trying to invent honeypots to keep them in their system. Those are all similar dynamics to cyber conflict today. So to us, that was already one of the first big lessons when we were getting into the structure, that there is this dynamic of cyber conflict, and it hasn't changed very significantly. You know, I came from the Air Force, signals intelligence, and you could get a fighter pilot. You know, imagine getting a fighter pilot from 1917, from any country, and getting together with fighter pilots, F-22 jocks from today, and, you know, you buy them enough beer, and within 2 or 3 minutes, they're going to be shooting down their watches, talking about great dog fights, slipping the Shirley Bond of Earth, you know, throwing on the air brakes so they fly right by. And they can communicate with each other after 100 years, even though technology has changed immensely. It's gotten far more lethal. Fighting in the air has happened over much faster speeds and over great distances and amazing altitudes. But despite all that, they can still talk to one another because the underlying dynamics of dogfighting hasn't changed. And we've found, even though you hear people saying how much cyber is changing, yeah, the technology changes. But if you look at the dynamics, we find it hasn't changed very much since that 1986.
So then, you know, walk us through, you know, in the 90s, what you call takeoff. I mean, what is the difference between sort of those events in during the 90s up to the early 2000s and sort of versus the cuckoo's egg?
Yeah. So the cuckoo's egg started things off, but we didn't really learn from it very much. After cuckoo's egg, we've had a series of 7 wake-up calls. And I don't call them wake-up calls. They were almost always called wake-up calls when they were going through them. Almost every single one of them had a senior DOD or White House official say, oh my gosh, this is a wake-up call. We need to take this cyber stuff seriously. Only for those leaders to move on, to get to other jobs, to leave government, and a new generation had to come in and go through similar wake-up calls. So when we look at those, the 2 years really stick out for us, both between the wake-up calls as well as the policy responses. So your first question, you asked about the structure, and we said, you know, up to 1986 up to 1998 was the first period. And 1998 was so important because we had 2 wake-up calls, a Pentagon exercise called Eligible Receiver, 1997, as well as a real-world incident called Solar Sunrise in 98 that really drove the Pentagon to action. The Deputy Secretary of Defense got all of his senior cyber team together, the information warfare team, they called it back then. He got them all in the Pentagon during Solar Sunrise to say, all right, who's in charge? Because they thought this was cyber war. There were some intrusions into the Air Force that looked like it was Saddam Hussein. Def Hamley gets everyone together, says, who's in charge? You know, all the senior leaders are like just whistling and looking around because no one is in charge. I'm told by people that were there that actually someone had to, one general had to kick another general's chair, and that general had to say, well, I guess I am, Mr. Secretary. So that's a very uncomfortable situation, and it led the military to say, all right, we need a specialized command of people that are really in charge and take this seriously. And that was the Joint Task Force Computer Network Defense. Also in 1998, you had a very influential presidential commission called the PCCIP, the President's Commission on Critical Infrastructure Protection, report out. And the next year, 1998, President Clinton signs a presidential directive, PDD 63, to push critical infrastructure protection and create some of the very first cybersecurity organizations, including the NIPC at the FBI. He also asked the private sector to kick off information sharing and analysis centers, ISACs, which are very well known today, though I think many of your readers. So 98 was one of these really pivotal years when things changed. The next pivotal year was 2003. And I can report, so I was at the JTF-CND during this period working with the NIPC, and boy, the years 1998 to 2003 were really rich. We were making a lot of progress. 2003, we kicked off the Department of Homeland Security. So, which was, beneficial overall to the nation, but it really slowed things down in cyber. So we've lost a lot of progress that I don't think we've really caught back up at yet. And because you had a very strong working group with the FBI and other organizations here, once DHS got involved, it sort of left the power vacuum that we've really seen the military, and especially General Alexander at NSA, really drive the military into that open space, which is why we call the current phase that we're in militarization.
So, I mean, sort of describe militarization for us. I mean, are we talking about, and this will sound sort of silly, but like an arms race? Are we talking about, you know, increased surveillance? Walk us through, you know, because I think for a lot of our audience, militarization has a specific sort of image and specific connotation, whereas, you know, you use it sort of, it has a different meaning in cyberspace.
Yeah. I'm not sure it necessarily has a different meaning in cyberspace. I mean a few things by that. I mean that within the United States, the Department of Defense and the intelligence community became the dominant, most powerful, most capable players in the domain when we're thinking about cyber policy. That the priorities of those organizations largely took over by default the priorities of the country. That I think we can talk about that in a sec. I think that comes up with surveillance. I think that comes up with Stuxnet and other areas. That in Washington, D.C., if you were talking about cyberspace, largely a debate came around about cyberspace as a warfighting domain. And many of your listeners will be used to that, but probably many of them have participated. But talking about cyberspace as a warfighting domain kind of lost sight that, well, no, cyberspace and the internet and the associated technologies are the most liberating technology for mankind since the printing press. And that if we think of it primarily in our debates as a warfighting domain, then we're probably overlooking lots of other things that it is and can do. I think the last couple of years has led us to a place where when we think in Washington, D.C. about cyber policy, and this is getting a bit away from the book, this ties into some in the book, but also I'm starting to get out of history and into my views on policy. We've gotten ourselves to a place, I think, where when we think about cyber power, militarization has given us a very skewed view on that. There's a time in the United States where if you thought about our maritime power, you didn't think about the U.S. Navy. You thought about the merchant seamen on U.S. flagged vessels that were carrying our trade to every corner of the earth. Now, when you say maritime power, you think of the Navy. America's cyber power, if you talk about that in Washington, D.C., because I think our policy has become militarized, that cyber power means Fort Meade. It means U.S. Cyber Command. It means NSA. It means whatever General Alexander says it means. But America's true cyber power isn't what happens on Route 32 and Canine Road. It's what happens in Route 128 in Boston, what happens out in Silicon Valley. It's the companies that are maintaining and creating cyberspace and the artists and citizens that use it for free speech and to push ideas out to the rest of the world. And I'm concerned, again, this is not out of a history, this is out of my, you know, speaking as a policy person at a Washington think tank, I'm afraid that we have gotten ourselves into such a military intel view of what cyberspace is about. It's leading us into mistaken policies. And I hope the president might agree with that right now, that now that he's been forced by this single view of national security and cyberspace to admit himself that we might have the balance wrong when we're looking at surveillance. I'd also argue that we have the balance wrong when we look at things like Stuxnet and lots of other military intel actions in cyberspace.
So, I mean, let's, before we get into sort of surveillance and those sort of larger political issues, I mean, describe for us, I mean, how does, when a state, this is sort of a more theoretical model, but when a state approaches, cyberspace, I mean, how does it, the information space, whatever you want to call it, I mean, how does it conceptualize, how do we conceptualize its capabilities? I mean, are we talking about, I mean,
Poorly, I think. We've been talking about, so we've been talking about cyberspace for a very long time, or internet and the related technologies. And it was really interesting as we were going through the book, many of the things that we were coming across were a bit of surprise about how long ago we had known some of these things. For example, one of my favorite quotes was, "Few, if any, contemporary computer security controls have prevented a red team from easily accessing any information sought." Now, I was just out at Black Hat and DEF CON, and I still heard people talking about that. But that quote actually comes from 1979. So we're obviously not getting things right when we're thinking about security. If you can take a quote from 1979 about how easy it is to get to break into systems, and it still makes sense today. One of the other ones that I think is at least is meaningful is that we realize we've been talking about a digital Pearl Harbor for 20 of the 70 years since the actual Pearl Harbor. We first started talking about it in 1991 when Schwartau testified to Congress. And of course, you're still hearing Leon Panetta and others talk about digital Pearl Harbors today. So we think when countries are thinking about cyberspace and what it means for military power, we're probably getting it wrong. Because if we've been afraid about nations, if we've felt vulnerable to a digital Pearl Harbor since 1991, and we know other countries are thinking about and developing these capabilities, then obviously, and no one's done it yet, we're still talking about it, it hasn't happened. But obviously, there's a different dynamic going on. So we feel nations, and especially the U.S., every country that follows the U.S. down this path, is probably overemphasizing the damage from disruptions. We can't find any evidence that anyone has died directly from a cyber attack. Cyber failures, yes, but not a cyber attack. So we think we're overestimating the chances for disruptive attack, but probably underestimating the chance for espionage or the implication of espionage until very recently. The other big split that we've seen in how nations have approached this is thinking about whether this is going to get used for the battle space, or this is going to get used as some special secret capability. And we think it's odd, the history of certainly the last 15 years has been showing that it doesn't tend to get used on the battlefield. It tends much more likely to be used as a secret covert means to screw your neighbor than to get used on the actual battlefield itself.
So, I mean, how do we interpret, before we get into the idea of threat and threatening, I mean, how do we, what does this do to our understanding of escalation and attribution? I mean, I think in the book you make this point that sort of cyber, the more you escalate, the more tension there is that, cyber sort of becomes subsumed under more traditional capabilities that really it all sort of goes back to blowing stuff up, so to speak.
Right. It's a great point. And what we realized going through this history was that a lot of what we are taught about cybersecurity, especially cyber conflict, and by cyber conflict we mean not just mere cybercrime, not what the Carters are doing or someone putting a picture of their butt on your web page, but the stuff that has the real national security implications. We found, if you hear from people what when they talk about that, there's a couple of themes. You hear them say, oh, it's always changing. The only constant is change. I hear that a lot. You hear network speed. General Alexander's always talking about how this is network speed. You hear difficulty of attribution. And there's a couple of difficulty of learning about this. It could happen like that. How two kids in their basement, you know, can have significant capability. And what we find when we looked at this as cyber conflict in history, we found that, yes, all of those things are true, but so what? They're only true at the tactical and technical level. They're only true at the level of bits and bytes. To put it in terms of fighting air, land, or sea, yes, it's true, for example, that cyber is speed of light. You know, that a cyber attack can happen as quickly as the bad guys can press the enter key. Very common theme coming out of Fort Meade recently. But, you know what, tactical combat in every domain is fast. You know, in the Air Force, you could be in a dogfight and shot down before you even know the bad guy's there. So when you keep talking about, but we find in cyber conflicts are rarely solved by a single attack, that the more strategically significant the conflict, the more likely they are to unfold over weeks, months, or even years. Look at Stuxnet. That wasn't speed of light. That was years long of going back and forth. Most cyber conflicts go back and forth between the good guys and the bad guys, between both sides of adversaries, over a long period of time. So, and they take place within an existing geopolitical crisis, an existing geopolitical conflict. So that means you tend to have lots of warning time because you know who the bad guys are, like Estonia. Estonia, 2007, attacked by Russia. That's not some weird, hard-to-understand cyber thing. That was an existing geopolitical crisis where it was obvious Russia was trying to bully its neighbor. You could see it coming weeks beforehand. The Estonians knew at least 2 weeks beforehand this was coming. And it means you don't have to worry so much about the technical attribution because it was obvious that if President Bush wanted that to stop, he didn't need to worry about technical attribution. He just needed to pick up the phone and call Putin. The last point, you asked about escalation. It is something that we worry about because we as computer security people have trained the policymakers to take this so seriously. We've been telling them that this is a matter of life and death, even though nobody's ever died. We tell them that someone could crash the United States, even though nothing like that has ever happened for the 20 years we've been talking about it. We've primed them, and by extension, their you know, other world leaders in every country, to worry about this so much that when we start seeing smaller conflicts that start getting Patriot hackers and others involved, I am really worried that when we see India-Pakistan, Patriotic hackers go at it again. When you start seeing East China Sea and South China Sea, we know Chinese hackers are gonna gear up. Japanese hackers, Korean hackers are going to get involved. And it is going to have this escalatory dynamic. They're not going to do any damage. It's going to be little propaganda crap that doesn't matter in at the strategic level. But we've scared our policymakers so much, they're going to feel they have to respond. We need to worry of the escalatory impact of these patriotic hackers because the leaders are going to feel like they have to respond because they've been told how dangerous cyber attacks are.
So, you know, I think just something left. I mean, how do you, what do you define as an attack? You know, what are you defining as an attack? I mean,
yeah.
I take it from our sort of conversation, this isn't, it's not just a matter of doing an nmap scan or even using Metasploit.
Right.
I mean, when we look at cyber capabilities and what have you, I mean,
right,
how do we define what is an attack? And even, you know, maybe even a sub point to that is, what is a cyber weapon? I mean, if there's something as a cyber weapon.
Yeah, I think within the U.S. and particularly the Pentagon, we've really been limiting ourselves on this because we always want to define it, and we want to define what's a cyber, what's an attack. and come up with precise definitions of these things. You know, is this information assurance? Is this cyber? Is this computer security? And the definitions don't serve us very well, whereas descriptions tend to be very much better. If we're describing, it tends to be like this. It has more looseness to it than definitions that DoD really likes. I mean, it's tough to put a description into Joint Code, you know, 1.002. But I like descriptions much better. So in our history book, we looked at cyber conflicts, which was anything that had cyber attack pretty loosely defined that was having national security implications. So definitely in was espionage, you know, nation state and nation state related espionage. We definitely included patriotic hackers, such as, you know, the Chinese groups that always come out and hit the U.S. or Asian neighbors, you know, Russians and Yugoslavs against NATO and the U.S. in 1999, Allied force bombing of the Serbs. We definitely included that in. We also include, you know, the real nation state stuff, like Stuxnet. So if we're including everything from web page defacements from patriotic hackers up to Stuxnet, that's a pretty wide range of stuff that we're including in Stuxnet. So we're just kind of going by malicious stuff that you do over the internet against someone else's, you know, that breaks, you know, the CIA, you know, the confidential integrity availability. So we're pretty loose on that. And so cyber weapons, again, I think it's, we get ourselves a bit too wound around the axle on the term weapons. It's, you know, most of them are more loose capabilities than weapons.
So, I mean, what does it do to the sort of the environment when, I mean, going from 1986 to 2013, I mean, it seems like, you know, the amount of tools and the amount of sort of, you know, knowledge has expanded. I mean, if you think about it, just using sort of looking at Metasploit, you know, Metasploit has gone from a command line tool to, I think now it's a GUI, it's a graphical user interface. It's, you know, you can use it on Windows, on a web browser. I mean, my point is that it's become really easy and really simple to a non-savvy sort of, you know, user to basically, I mean, to use a basic set of exploits. So, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, does that represent a sort of shift? I mean, or, you know, what is it?
I don't think so. You know, it's a really interesting point. And thanks for pulling it out. To one degree, I was hearing presentations from the CIA in 1998 where they were saying the things that non-states can do now had been the province of, you know, the sole monopoly of nation-states 5 years ago. And so, to me, this is more of the same. You know, again, just coming back to Black Hat DEF CON, yeah, we're seeing all sorts of stuff out there that would have made, you know, that I'm sure only nations were doing a couple of years ago, but that seems to be a trend, rather than anything new. But it's such a good question. It made me think back to the last question where you're asking about, what do you mean by weapons and capabilities? And it made me think of two or three different bits that I'm about to take a few minutes on. And I hope you don't mind. I'm going a bit longer on my answers than I would in a normal interview or podcast. But I know we've got 45 minutes or an hour. So are we doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay, because I can keep short answers and you can get in more questions if you prefer. Just let me know.
No, just go as long as you want.
Yeah, I think us in the computer security community, and then by default, we've passed this along to the policymakers in D.C. We talk so much about incidents and weapons and capabilities that even when I talk to generals, very senior generals, they end up talking about specific capabilities. We've gotten very transactional about how we worry about cyber. And what I mean by that is we keep thinking about these one-off things that might happen. I was in a a meeting with very senior members of the Air Force. There, I counted 19 stars in the room of various calibers on different shoulders. And the discussion kept coming back to what capabilities does the Air Force have? What specific things can we do in cyberspace that might help define us as a service? But we don't normally think about warfare as a successive use of capabilities. You know, if you think about conflicts in air, land, and sea and what the Navy, Air Force, or Army want to accomplish, it's not unleash a series of serial capabilities against the bad guy or defend ourselves against a serial set of capabilities that they unleash upon us. No, it's this constant back and forth in conflict. And this is one of the things that really struck us when we were doing the book, is that there's almost no thinking going on in the United States right now that looks at cyberspace as more than just a series of one-off capability use against the other guy. We find very little thinking about campaigns. Okay, we use this capability, they're going to do this. What happens 3 moves down, 5 moves down, 15 moves down? We're not planning in our plans that DHS is doing or DOD is doing, it's not that very obvious to us watchers, of planning for 3, 6, 1 year of back and forth against the bad guy. And we think this is really worrying. It's our generals at really senior levels are talking about what happens in the foxhole. Great, we're going to do this single thing to the bad guy. We don't need generals that do that. That's why our generals keep talking about network speed. Anytime you hear someone talking network speed or capabilities, they're worried about the foxhole and the tactical fight. But what we found in the history is that it's very easy in cyber. It's just as easy as in the other domains to abstract up from that technical level and think about the bigger picture about the campaign and the larger conflict. To get specifically into where you were going with Metasploit and some of these other things, because of this transactional tactical mindset that we've gotten ourselves into, I heard from the Air Force 4-star general that's in charge of cyber, was just about a year ago, and he talked about how it's tough to do deterrence when teenagers in their basement or the garage can have a strategic capability. And I'll tell you, that notion, it's true that the stuff that you can do now with Metasploit and with industrial control systems is amazing. But it's just crap that 2 kids in their basement can have a strategic capability. It's just crap, and it has been. It may not be 5 years from now, but it has been crap. They can do interesting things, yes. Internet makes it very easy to take a target down. It's very easy. But it is incredibly difficult to keep it down over time. Look at Shamoon. Shamoon, General Alexander will tell you, oh my God, this is crazy. They just essentially destroyed 30,000 computers by messing with the BIOS. Great. That is interesting. But if you believe the other things that we hear from the government, that this was intended to disrupt Saudi oil production. You know what? Shamoon didn't disrupt Saudi oil production. It was a failure. It was a complete failure from the operational and strategic sense because they did not achieve what we think their objective was. So we need generals that think about the bigger picture here rather than the tactical bit. So now nations, especially the top tier nations like China, the United States, Russia, maybe Israel, if they were going to do a Shamoon type attack, they would do their battle, they would hit the target, they would do their battle and damage assessment, realize that the target was going to come back up, and have additional capabilities to restrike it so they could keep it down over time. And that is, for right now, not in the province of non-state actors to a large degree.
I mean, where would you put botnets in all this? I mean, it seems like, you know,
right.
I mean, it seems like as a non-state actor, you do have the capability to create networks of huge computing power. I mean, to your point, I mean, it is used for, spamming and credit card fraud, but I mean, do you think there will ever be a sort of transition point where somebody will create a botnet and go openly manipulate a financial system, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. To some degree, maybe we've just gotten lucky. Because if you say, all right, what botnets have had a strategically significant impact on another country? I mean, can you come up with any examples? I mean, about the only one I can come up with is maybe Estonia. But the Russian attacks on Estonia didn't really have a significant impact on GDP. They had a couple of bad leaks, but they were more worried about the riots that were going on in town at the time. So botnets, I just don't quite see that are there yet. They might give you a bad, a bad couple of days, but they haven't had the kind of thing that can give a country a bad couple of weeks, or certainly not a bad quarter. They're not there yet to digital Pearl Harbor. Now, maybe they will be. What really worries me is the scale of botnets could get significantly worse. I'm seeing, with recursive DNS servers, with open recursive DNS servers, with other technologies that are out there. Yeah, we could, I think, see significantly bad botnets. But I also have a lot of faith in the tier one and the botnet defense community, that if that happened, we might be able to get ourselves into a good place within a couple of days. What really worries me, so in D.C., I'm one of the people that says cyber is not that bad. It really isn't as bad as we've been scaring people about. What really scares me longer term is in the industrial control systems. Because you remember one of the rules of thumb that I said a couple minutes ago, it's easy to take something down, but it's difficult to keep it down. And it's easy to take something down because you're only taking things down that are made of bits and bytes, or silicon, and that tends to be pretty fragile. But it's also easy to replace. Saudi Aramco could use their business continuity plan. They could put these in place. When I used to lose term papers when I was writing my old MS-DOS system, and it would suck when I would lose it. I have to rewrite the term paper, but it wasn't the end of the world. That was when all we had connected was bits and bytes and silicon. With industrial control systems, we are rushing forward to put things that are made of concrete and steel and connecting them to the internet. And that's what really scares me, because when cyber can break concrete and steel, then people really will die. And we are interconnecting it so fast and generally adding in security afterwards that it might really put us in a different place in 3 years, 5 years, that we will finally have that digital Pearl Harbor, and that it will be in the range of non-states to really bring up a body count.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, in that sense, is the Internet of Everything a liability? I mean, I think yesterday...
Oh, of course.
Oh, go ahead.
No, please go ahead and finish.
I mean, I think yesterday somebody had revealed that they had been able to get into the Philips light control system. So if you have a house, where you can control the lights, wirelessly, apparently. But the point that the article made was that the system was not secure at all. In fact, that to your point, that security had sort of been the second, when they were programming it and coming up with the system, it had been a second or third concern, as opposed to the first concern, which was, I want to light up my house using my iPhone.
Right. And so that all worries me when it's at the end points. What really scares the bejesus out of me is when it's not at the end, the consumer end point, but at the industrial end point, at the dams, at the power plants, at the water systems. And I think the more that we're internet everything, which of course we're going to do, it makes so much sense for convenience, for the environment, for the economy. Of course we're going to do it. I would hope that we would do it smart, and that we wouldn't do it the way we've done everything else related to cyberspace, that we in the internet, you know, that we rush forward and add security afterwards. I'm not convinced we're going in that way. We've been talking about this in two different ways. I'll only pick one of them now. I'll try to come back to the other one later. But your listeners will know, it's been, you know, since 86, even before, it's always been easier to attack than defend in the internet, right? You know, we as defenders have a tougher time of it for all sorts of different reasons. And so we say O is greater than D. It's easier to do offense than defense. You know, I always imagine it was like one of the little greater than crocodiles going to eat the O, like we learned in grade school. But it doesn't have to be that way. In every other kind of human conflict, the balance between offense and defense shifts all the time, right? I mean, Napoleon could charge around with his cavalry and his cannons, and you know, they were dominant in the early 1800s. And generals just didn't have enough imagination to think it could be otherwise. You know, through the 1860s, and American generals getting their troops slaughtered because they hadn't realized that rifle shots had gotten more accurate and fast, all the way up through World War I. 100 years, generals were too stupid to realize that now defense had gotten better than offense. And it switched back to offense being greater than defense when generals in Germany realized you could take a few disruptive technologies, radio, aircraft, and armor, put it together with the right doctrine, usage, to put them all together, and now all the things shifted back to offense. So we need to be more imaginative. We shouldn't be stuck like those American Civil War generals to think that we're stuck in the balance between offense and defense that it is, that we have today. I'm really worried that with what we know now about American surveillance, about things like Stuxnet, which I think absolutely represent this militarization of cyber policy in the United States, with our rushing forward with an insecure Internet of Things, with several other trends, we're going to make it so that offense isn't just easier than defense, it is way easier than defense. That we'll be at a place where you can't, you know, it's easier to talk than defend today, but if you need in the internet, it's probably going to be there, right? You know, great, the New York Times is almost always up. It goes down, it's just for an hour. You can make fun of them, but it doesn't really change their business model. We might get ourselves to a place where the internet is so untrustworthy that you just can't expect that it's going to be there when you need it. We might have an unsustainable internet that we pass down to our kids and grandkids, an internet that's less free, less secure, less awesome than the one that we grew up with. And part of that is because the U.S. government hasn't decided that our goal is to make defense better than offense. And until we decide that we really want defense better than offense, we're certainly never going to get there.
Interesting. So let's switch gears a little and talk about, you know, how is policy made? Because I think the most notable thing about your book is that the reader is introduced to policy, to not just policy as in one or two documents, but rather the give and take of, you know, the military guys are over here, Treasury guys, FBI guys, everybody is, you know, trying to get something. But I want to start off this line of questioning with, you know, who are the actors within the policy realm? I mean, not just in terms of the public, so the government and, you know, the different offices associated with the executive and Congress, but also the private, so sort of your Googles, your Microsofts, and your other developers. I mean, you know, take us through this sort of, you know, how is policy constructed between these actors?
Yeah, the private sector has a big advantage here. In our constitutional form of government in the United States, the federal government can only do that which it is authorized to do. Now, within its space, it's got lots of resources to port problems, but it can only do what it's authorized. The private sector can do everything that isn't prohibited. So a very different view based of what the two actors can get up to. Later on, we can talk about how I think it's, our cyber policy is not taking advantage of that as much as we might. So you're able to see these companies that are able to go out and get a lot done and able to really push and get lots of de facto cyber policy done by inventing it. You know, so we didn't, they can create cyber policy by inventing new things like the cloud and big data centers and Google and the rest. So DC is always going to be chasing after that because we can only do that so it's authorized. Within, you've got the main policy officially, if you look at it as a wiring diagram, and you've got White House at the top, the Michael Daniel and his team, he's the White House cyber coordinator. He's got about 10 people at the White House to help on cyber issues. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but that's not significantly smaller than the size of the team the president has in the White House to oversee the intelligence community, to oversee the Department of Defense. I mean, those teams are maybe 15 people. So having 10 is actually not a bad little group of people at the White House. That's on the Security Council side. There's another much even smaller than that group at the National Economic Council that helps look at the Office of Management and Budget that looks at some of the more civilian issues of internet policy. You know, can you jailbreak phones? And until recently, they didn't have a procedure to bring in policy issues, have them looked at by lower level staff, brought up to senior level officials that make a decision that the president can confirm if needed. The NSC, the National Security Council, had a long-standing process for that. It's only been recently that the commercial-private sector side of the White House policy got caught up to having that process. Great props to my colleague David Edelman for putting that into place. Under that, of course, you've got DHS. They've got the on paper, they've got all of the significant responsibilities. But since 2003, they've never really gotten themselves into the place to act on it. They've been able to do good things, but always a couple of steps behind the private sector and certainly a couple of steps behind the Department of Defense. State Department, again, has about maybe 10 people that are looking at diplomacy to help on this. But if you imagine 10 people, led by Chris Painter, one of America's true cyber statesmen. He started out as a prosecutor that prosecuted Kevin Mitnick, and he's been in almost every important decision for American cyberspace since. But with 10 people, he's got so much less oomph than the Department of Defense. So with 10 people, he has to try and do bilaterals with Russia, with China, with Brazil, with Israel, with the United Kingdom. He's trying to do Five Eyes agreements with the English-speaking allies, you know, Canada, England, I'm sorry, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand. He's trying to work with the UN. He's trying to push back the influence of the ITU so that we don't get a balkanized internet. So 10 people isn't a very big staff compared to the international outreach that, for example, DoD can bring. So when you have an issue, they'll all have their own opinions. They'll all have their own internal strategies. But it's really at the White House in the interagency process where this comes together. So Michael Daniel will have his team through the, it's called the ICI-IPC. I won't try and break that apart. But it's it is like any other policy issue once it starts getting up to the White House. The president will have his team that will call together an interagency policy committee to start working at the issues, start working through the equities of the different departments involved, and trying to find what are the common solutions based on what the president believes he owes the electorate.
Interesting. So in this sort of interagency sort of interaction and debate, I mean, where do we put the FBI and where do we put the Treasury Department? Because, I mean, it seems like, you know, following the legal debate, you know, the domestic legal debate when it comes to sort of cyber, it seems like, you know, especially with Treasury, they don't know, Treasury, from what I've read, has a voice but doesn't have an enforcement arm. That is, they have to rely on the FTC and sort of, the Federal Trade Commission and other organizations. But I mean, where do we put traditional law enforcement and the Treasury Department within this sort of debate?
Yeah, Treasury only really plays that I've seen when we're looking at critical infrastructure protection for the finance sector itself. I've also read Dick Clark has told us that if the United States were going to attack a finance sector overseas, that essentially the Secretary of the Treasury gets a veto over that because of the potential for blowback. FBI injustice at the policy level, FBI is not going to be the real player. It's going to be justice, since they have the political appointees and the others. And they'll be representing the law enforcement angle. And together, we have what I would call the American consensus on cybersecurity policy. And it's probably been in place since about 1998, since President Clinton did PDD 63. And the American consensus says you should build your capability, you should look at infrastructure protection, you should, there's a couple elements that are part of the U.S. national security, I'm sorry, the national cyber strategy. Worry about patching systems, worry about information sharing, include an international component. And that American consensus has really been copied by most other countries. If you look at their national strategies, they're going to look pretty similar to ours in the kinds of things that they include. You know, maybe they've got different, sectors that are in critical infrastructure. Maybe they've got a slightly different relationship with their companies, so they can force the companies to do things in ways that we necessarily can't. But overall, they're going to be pretty similar. That surprises me a bit, because again, if you look at these quotes from the 1970s, 80s, 90s, it's not obvious that we've made any progress. Of course, we've made progress on the margins, but the core problems from 70s, 80s, and 90s, we still have. So I think regardless of the process by that when we get through that policy, I haven't seen that it's making a significant difference.
I mean, how would you describe sort of the private sector's role in sort of creating this policy? I mean, it seems like...
Yeah, they don't...
Oh, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
No, I mean, it seems like Microsoft, especially, and, is, I mean, it seems like they're very much visible. I don't know if that visibility translates into sort of policy success, but, they definitely have a security arm that's not shy about lobbying and sort of making its views known on how to deal with, securing, updating computers, bounty programs, et cetera. So, I mean, what has been the role of the private sector in sort of shaping policy, cyber policy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think where you've seen the influence most is maybe less, or where I've seen it most, is less in the individual companies than the role of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in being able to essentially veto a lot of the legislation that might have had a more regulatory component to it. A lot of potential laws in Congress have gotten knocked down because of the U.S. Chamber. Now, the U.S. Chamber might have just been carrying the water for the companies that you mentioned here. There's also, but I don't see it quite as strongly role in policy here as I do in other countries. The Dutch, for example, and the Netherlands, the companies are in at the level of governance. The top level cyber policy body of the Netherlands includes several Dutch companies, including the essentially the tier one telecoms provider. So there are different advisory councils in DC, but nothing like that kind of direct influence on policy. I have to say, I don't mind a lot of the roles of the companies that are playing, because I think the government had a long time to try and come up with solutions, and it's not obvious that it's worked. Moreover, when I've looked at this as history, it's very difficult to find any cyber conflict that was decisively resolved by government. It has almost always been the private sector that has decisively resolved the significant cyber incident. About the only exceptions are cases like Solar Sunrise or Buckshot Yankee, where the private sector wasn't the one being affected. It was pretty much only the government that was suffering. All the other cases, it's the private sector that's been at the root of it. So I think we certainly at the level of cyber conflict. And again, this isn't necessarily for fixing all of the cybersecurity problems that we have. I think the government has a pretty flawed model. Remember what we said before, the private sector can do anything that isn't prohibited. Government can only do that which is authorized. And if you hear a lot of the statements, especially those coming from Fort Meade, they tend to go around, we need the private sector to tell us so we can take action to stop something. That is exactly the opposite of what we need. If the private sector can see something and stop it, the government should be enabling that to happen with everything we can, with resources, with information, with money, to help make sure that can happen so that the companies can stop the stuff happening so it doesn't have to become a government problem. Just to summarize my view on this, and I'm going to use a military phrase here, and hopefully that will be familiar to the readers. In cyber conflict, it's the private sector is the supported command, not the supporting command. If you look at most of DC policy, we are treating the private sector like they have to give us here in the Beltway the information and the things that we need so that then the Secretary of DHS or General Alexander can make the decision of what should happen and then pass out the instructions for the private sector to execute. That's how the draft National Cyber Incident Response Plan is written. And that's not the way that cyber conflict, you know, the serious cyber incidents happen. The government needs to change our mindset that the good things that happen in cyberspace are done overwhelmingly by the private sector. The bad things that need to get fixed are overwhelmingly in the private sector. And the more that we try and solve that by building more bureaucracy, by giving more money to Fort Meade, the farther away we're getting from solutions that are going to actually matter.
It's interesting. I mean, that really brings us to our sort of last sort of point of discussion is, you know, it really does seem like that the NSA has not only taken a lead, but it certainly shapes a lot of these dynamics. I mean, especially, I mean, I think, I'll just say, I mean, what do we do about surveillance then? I mean, it seems like, you know, with these NSA controversies, you know, this... When I say controversies, let me sort of clarify the terms. I'm referring to sort of the stuff we learned from the Snowden leaks, so the Verizon order, Prism, metadata. And then even let's throw in lava bit closures and sort of looking at the Tor network, the closing down of Tor mail, and then even for, you know, people who use Silent Circle, the discontinuation of the email service. I mean, is there a fine line? I mean, is there a sort of fine line between, you know, the NSA being a signals intelligence organization and looking at everything that's happening on the network and sort of outright surveillance and surveillance of a lot of people and bullying? I mean,
it's a great point, and you know, my background, I was a signals intelligence officer for the Air Force. My first assignment was a listening post that was on U.S. soil in Alaska. And one of my jobs there was to run the program to make sure that we weren't listening to U.S. people and that if we did accidentally collect it, that we followed the procedures to make sure that it didn't get into the permanent records and we minimized the impact of having done that. It would actually happen about once a week that we would pick up an American. You know, we were an HF site, so 3 to 30 megahertz, and it would happen that one of the collectors would just open a file and he would enter in what he had heard, and it would turn out, you know, a couple minutes later that it was a U.S. call sign, you know, like an American fishing vessel. It was embarrassing. We didn't punish him. We trained him so that he would make sure that he would know it. He would get teased by his colleagues. He might get an extra duty, you know, like he might have to mop that night, you know, but it wasn't. It happened. We dealt with it. It was, and we did what we could to drive it towards zero because it wasn't right. And I was very proud of that. When I saw the latest things from NSA, from the Snowden revelations, I was aghast at the scope. But also, you know, I got to hear General Alexander in Black Hat, and as much as I was aghast at the scope, I was pleased to hear the controls that were behind this. Because let's face it, the Guardian has a tempo to this where they'll reveal shocking news, and only, you know, 2 weeks later do they report the controls on it. So let me put, that's all preface to my punchline, which is, I agree with you to a large degree. I would even add in Stuxnet. I came out at the time of saying Stuxnet is not in the U.S. national interest, that we've got a single view of national security that sees cyberspace as a playground for the military and intelligence, that this particular view that doesn't see there any reasons for U.S. restraint in how we use our covert activities and our surveillance in cyberspace was going to come back and it was going to bite us. And, you know, I got a little bit of a talking to. I had senior people in the administration come talk to me and say, Jay, you don't know what you're talking about. This stuff isn't going on like what you think. We got this. It's under control. And I think with this known revelation, it makes mockery of that. It goes to show that I believe Washington, D.C., has a blind spot on this, about how this gets seen. You know, cyberspace is young. You know, it has a history, which you can buy at Amazon, Kindle version, $9.99. But it's still relatively young, and the future is a jump ball. And the kinds of things, and it might be that the internet is far more sensitive to wide-scale spying by covert actions of stabbing your neighbor under the table, like Iran is doing to us and we're doing to Iran. And that might really ruin cyberspace for future generations. I think General Alexander had strong controls on this within his organization. I'm not worried about that. I'm much more worried about the view of national security that say you can be unlimited in this stuff and you only have to worry about getting caught. Because I'm afraid we're ruining cyberspace. Go ahead.
I agree with you that there are sort of controls and audits, but I mean, in the sense that these revelations have sort of, have they stressed the relationship between the U.S. government and the private sector? Because it seems...
Go ahead. I told you, I think our America's cyber power are our companies that are building, maintaining and building cyberspace, that are pushing the bounds. America's cyber power are our artists and writers that are filling it with content that the rest of the world wants. And this narrow militarized view of cyber power, represented by General Alexander and the NSA team, that view of cyber power are going to, without a doubt, impact the rest of us that see that we have a future in American cyberspace, without a doubt. You know, President Obama, he could come out and say, we believe, here's our vision of what the world should be, but the world is a dangerous place. And so we still need to drone people. You know, we still need to kill them where they are while they're sleeping. And we know some people don't like it, but we'll have controls on it, but here's our greater vision. And we never did that for cyberspace. Our strategies, the international strategy for cyberspace, it only talks about how cyberspace is a beautiful, pure place that's filled with American values and that we want to be open and free and secure. Because the NSA crowd has driven conversations about surveillance and offense deeply into the classified zones so that people like you and me rarely can have a voice in the debate. And it's really killing us now, because now people are looking at it. We said cyberspace was about peace and freedom. And when you're telling everyone cyberspace is peace and freedom, be about peace and freedom, and now they see our actions don't match our words in ways that I think are going to be deeply affect not just American companies, not just American citizens and their privacy, but also the future of cyberspace itself. Our real policy isn't what the president said in those wonderful things. The U.S. military and intelligence community are making the policy on the ground through surveillance and covert action.
I mean, where would you put, you know, I mean, sort of it seems like the real point of friction here is the U.S. government, and not just the U.S. government, but other governments going out and buying zero days. So, I mean, where do you, I mean, do you consider that as a sort of necessary action for defense and sort of attack? Or do you think that's really unnecessary and and the zero day market should be something closer to a freer market where, you know, the government doesn't necessarily participate in it and it's left up to the private sector to sort of resolve?
Yeah, I'm still in the midst of my thinking about this. When we first started seeing, you know, so I was going through or watching from the sidelines the debates on vulnerability disclosure and responsible disclosure, 10, 15 years ago. I was happy we solved that. I was actually really happy when companies like iDefense started to get in and would start paying for vulnerabilities and helping create this legitimate market. Because I was tired of the bad guys having the only markets. So I was pleased when we started going down this vulnerability market. Now I think it's gotten, I don't know what I think, because it's gotten so carried away with the zero-day market as it is. And I think American policy is, we're caught. Because part of this might be the U.S. government might be saying, you know what, we should be trying to shut down this market or drive it into more legitimate channels so that it's only companies like iDefense, like iSight Partners, like Symantec McAfee or others that are buying these. But we're so happy to have this market so that NSA and the military can buy some of the zero days that I think we're probably of two minds in the government. And I'm still working through that myself of whether I think I liked the market when it started coming around. And I'm really caught about this. If anything, I think, you know, the money that the U.S. government spends on, I wonder if the U.S. government should be a bigger player in the market, but actually getting the zero days into defense. You know, every zero day that the U.S. government uses to spy or defend is another vulnerability that's open on American systems. If we really cared about defense, if our policy was really a secure, peaceful, free internet, we would not be using our zero days to attack Iranian centrifuges. We'd be using those zero days to patch American systems.
So let's sort of end the show with, you know, tomorrow the Obama administration comes to you and says, you know, Jason, write your cyber policy. You know, you can write it, you can implement it. You know, what would be your sort of ideal policy?
It's got only a couple elements. One, we've got to change what we've done because it's obviously not working. The American consensus national security strategy doesn't work. Or it doesn't work fast enough. It really hit me when I was rereading about irregular warfare. General Petraeus's strategy for counterinsurgency was population-centric coin, you know, win the hearts and minds. There was another group that said, no, 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 negate that. It's not that. It's you got to kill the bastards. you know, it's insurgent-centric and you have to kill them. And that made me think, you know, the most successful national security strategy ever was containment. Contain the Soviet Union. That strategy, you know, those are one-word strategies, two, three, four-word strategies. And if you kind of know what they mean by that, you can have nth-level ideas with someone smart to think about what population-centric coin means or what containment means and how you might do it. What's our cyber strategy? You can't express it in any fewer words than it takes to include every single component idea. Jane Holt, the former deputy director of DHS, was better than anyone else I've heard. But essentially, you can't really do it in fewer than 15 words or so. So my strategy would start with non-state-centric cyber strategy. I would take U.S. companies and non-state groups like NANOG, like NSPSEC, like Corporate Certs and others, and I would take them from the fringes, and I would say, our job is to support you. What can we do on that? Put them at the center. Because it even changes how you do regulation. To me, regulating for security standards, like we're doing now through NIST, is a top-down government approach. I would try and regulate for transparency. If you put non-states at the center, you use the existing corporate governance structures to enforce the right behavior. That means shareholders holding board directors accountable. So if this problem is as bad as we think it is, the government shouldn't be reaching out to CISOs. We should be reaching out to shareholders like CalPERS. We should be telling board directors that this is a serious problem. We should be putting governance structures in place like the SEC guidance that says boards have to take this seriously, that this is a material failure, and report it to their shareholders. We're much more likely to get success at least cost doing that than the ways that we're going.
Interesting. Well, yeah. We always like to end to really end the interview with, you know, giving the guest the last word and sort of whatever they want to leave the audience with as the last word.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening. You can get defense better than offense in cyberspace. So that should be our goal. If you're interested in cybersecurity, your goal, whether it's your own company, whether it's for your sector, whether it's for the United States, or whether it's the internet as a whole, we need to be aiming to get defense better than offense. Because if you're not getting defense better than offense, we are going to have the same problems in 10, 15, 20 years. And we look back at these quotes from 1979 that says red teams can always get through. We're still going to be seeing those quotes 20 years from now. If defense is not better than offense for cyberspace as a whole, we are wasting our time. That has to be our goal. That has to be where our policy drives us. That has to be where our technology drives us. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for coming on.